Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Roberta Brandes Gratz. Her new book is We're Still Here, You Bastards, How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City. I'll also talk with poet Amy King, who recently received the Bookwoman Award from the Women's National Book Association for her work with VITA, Women in the Literary Arts. Roberta Brandes Gratz is a distinguished urbanist who divides her time between New York and New Orleans. She's the author of The Battle for Gotham, New York in the Shadow of Robert Moses and Jane Jacobs, Cities Back from the Edge, New Life for Downtown, The Living City, How America's Cities Are Being Revitalized by Thinking Small in a Big Way, and, I love this title, A Frog, A Wooden House, A Stream, and A Trail, 10 Years of Community Change in Central Europe. But her most recent book focuses on post-Katrina New Orleans, and it's got a title everyone here will love, We're Still Here, You Bastards, How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City. Roberta, welcome to The Reading Life.
It's very good to be here.
So, this feisty title, very much
in
the spirit.
It's a feisty city.
Yes, it is. So tell us where it came from.
It was a real graffiti right after Katrina, and a friend of mine happened to get a photograph of it. But it kind of says it all, at least the feeling that I saw exhibited after Katrina, where outsiders said, that, yes. How can the city recover? It will never recover, shouldn't recover, or whatever. And everybody said, excuse me, we're still here, you bastards.
And we are recovering.
And we are recovering, or we will recover.
Now, you said at the beginning of this book that you've mentioned New Orleans in three of your previous works, and you visited the city a lot over the years, but that you don't necessarily value it for the things that other people value it for. You value it for its urbanism. So describe for us what urbanism means to you, and how does someone become an urbanist?
Well, first let me explain that over the years that I've been traveling in cities all over the country and across the globe, I've been observing cities, what makes them work, how they fall apart, how they come back together. And over the course of time, I had visited New Orleans a couple of times. For my first book, I had written about the French Quarter. That was in 1989. And what I admired about the French Quarter, which at the time was the largest historic district in the country, eventually, South Beach surpassed it. But at the time, what the French Quarter showed was that if you have a truly urban neighborhood, which it was with all the streets and the mixture of uses, residential and commercial, in balance, you could have a street like Bourbon Street with all that it represented, not far away from a coexisting residential neighborhood, which still in 1989 was very much a residential neighborhood, had not yet been taken over by the short-term rental tourism market. So I wrote about that in the first book. And in the second book, I had an emphasis in some ways, in part, on transit and how important transit was to preserve a real city versus dependency on cars and highways, mm-hmm. which break up cities and really create suburbs. And I had come to learn that the St. Charles streetcar, which was one of the few left in the entire country, had in many ways played such a significant role in the revival of the Garden District, which many people, certainly outside of New Orleans, don't realize at one point was not in good shape. Mm-hmm. But the transit was the connector that kept the mixed uses, the not creating a total dependency on the car. Then in my last book, on the Moses Jacobs book, I observed how the fight against the expressway had really saved the city, because the expressway would have essentially destroyed so much of the French Quarter. You would not have the appeal to both resident and visitor alike that you have today. And that, of course, was in the 60s. But even more recently, for people who would remember, there was a ramp from the highway that came down right into Coliseum Square, which at the time destroyed that neighborhood. And when it was removed, helped revive it. And Coliseum Square is an extraordinary neighborhood now.
Yes, it is.
Because of the removal of the ramp. So all those things were, for me, not unlike other examples in other cities. But, you know, watching Katrina and then coming down right after, 3 weeks later, and doing my first story and starting to get into places I had never been, I realized that the parts of New Orleans that I had visited and written about was the tip of the iceberg. Mm-hmm. And what I discovered was something that I had not yet seen in the scale that you see it here, a low-rise, intimate city that is truly urban because of its street grid, its mix of uses within neighborhoods, wonderful short neighborhood shopping streets, restaurants, corner stores, small shops mixed in with residential, all small in scale, none creating big parking lots, no real disruption of the grid and the street continuity. This is what urbanism is. The music, the food, the culture, and the splendid architecture, which of course I loved. That's all the icing on the cake. But the foundation of the cake is your grid and your mix of uses and the ease in which you get around, even though, unfortunately, you're still too much of a car-dependent city, and in fact, getting more so.
Mm-hmm. So you have this fascinating mix of institutions and how they failed in post-Katrina, and you have great, great stories of individual activists who just took matters into their own hands and made a terrific difference. So I wonder if you talk about some of the more memorable characters in this book.
Oh, boy, how do you choose? Let me say first that it's always those people in every city that I've written about. I don't think I've focused as much in the other books on the people that I focused on here. Maybe I was more inspired. I'm not sure. I think probably more inspired because the adversity was so strong. Mm-hmm. The first story that I did when I came down here of this gentleman who I got to go into Holy Cross 3 weeks after Katrina. And people might remember that it was 4 months. The last people allowed in their neighborhood was in the lower Ninth Ward. But 3 weeks after Katrina, the water was gone in the Holy Cross neighborhood for sure. And with my press credentials, they let me in with this gentleman. It was a very modest, actually a cinder block house, looked nothing like all the charming Holy Cross houses. It was beyond measure. I mean, everything was, you know, I don't have to describe for New Orleanians what the house looked like. Painfully, you all know too well. But he looked it all around and he said, well, it was as bad when I bought it and I fixed it once, I'll do it again. And I was so inspired by that. I mean, I would have walked away and just cried my eyes out for weeks and never looked back, or at least I think I would have. And then I came back with some students a couple of months later, and we traveled around neighborhoods, talked to people in Gentilly, I talked to people, I don't even remember where they were. And the determination to overcome the impediments was beyond measure. The frustration with the trailers and then meeting people who had trailers parked in their parking lot that they couldn't use because the right properly affiliated contractor had not come to connect the electricity or the plumbing, which that owner could have done himself. Mm-hmm. But the feeding frenzy of the out-of-town contractors was so that that was one of the big impediments. But they were determined, and they were there fixing their homes.
And that, for me, was one of the great strengths of this book, the way you do unravel that financial mismanagement and break it down layer by layer by layer. It's stunning.
Well, I mean, I became enraged, as so many of you did. I've seen a lot of this before, but I've never seen the kind of political, I don't want to say shenanigans, but that's what it was. When you look at all the out-of-state and outside contractors that got enormous contracts for New Orleans, for post-Katrina, and when you look at the breakdown, which I do in the book, of some of the contracts, like the blue tarp that started at $57 a square and subcontracted for 40-something and subcontracted for 30-something. None of those had yet done anything except make money. And the poor guy on the ground getting $2 a square to install. So I put together as many of these contracts as I could find, because you have fabulous local journalists who dug them all up, and some from other news out-of-state newspapers. And I just put them all together. And one after another, I was stunned. And I make a projection in the book, which basically nobody can contradict, because nobody has put the numbers together. Out of the billions that came here post-Katrina, I don't think more than 20% hit the ground. That's not a lot.
Oh, staggering.
And all those contractors were mostly out of state. They were not local. The subcontractors were, but they got the peanuts.
Right. And the other thing you trace in this book that you see is so important to the city is the loss of Charity Hospital and the loss of public housing and how that's changed the entire face of New Orleans.
The loss of Charity Hospital to me is symbolic of the worst kind of insult to a city and its people and its integrity that you can find nationwide. And I've seen a lot of them. I've written a lot of them. We have them in New York too. But on every level, Charity was egregious. And it cannot be forgotten. I wrote about it in an article in The Nation magazine 3 years ago. But I have to say, one of the good things that has happened since is this wonderful film on Charity Hospital that's been shown a lot in the city. A lot of people have seen it. It's been able to capture things that I couldn't, because the film was of the hospital people, the staff, the community, and how they dealt with the patients. I dealt with the process on how Charity was restored, patient ready 3 weeks later, and closed with an agenda that was totally egregious from start to finish, and the fact that there was an alternative, a cheaper, quicker, better modernization alternative of the existing Charity. And every level of government was complicitous. Every level. The head of HUD, everybody knew. So Charity is a classic case of the kind of top-down mistakes that I write about in the book and have written about in all my other books. Public housing issue was slightly different, because the public housing issue had many aspects. One major one was that it was a national agenda issue, started in the Nixon administration to project by project eliminate public housing and privatize it. They would never have been able to do what they did here if Katrina hadn't happened. Politically, it would never have flown. That's one level. The other level is the brick buildings that were torn down were just unbelievably valuable, not just in their architectural simplicity or detail, but we're in a day and age when you don't waste what is really already solid. Those buildings could have been hollowed out in a new way. Some could have been eliminated to put back the grid that was removed. They could have been re-energized in so many ways. But that wasn't the agenda. The agenda was not about doing the right thing with the asset. The agenda was to privatize, to disperse poverty, which is a ridiculous idea, as if that has an impact on crime, other than disperse it and move it around. So there are many levels different from Charity that are lessons in public housing story, and I tried to cover as much of it as I could.
Well, the book is a whole survey of public life. You know, every institution that really matters is in here, I think. And I learned a lot from reading it. We've been talking with Roberta Brandes Gratz, whose new book is We're Still Here, You Bastards, How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City. Roberta, thank you so much.
Well, it's been a thrill to be here.
Louisiana. Louisiana. They're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away. Louisiana. Louisiana. They're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away.
Amy King is a fierce advocate for women and for poetry. She teaches creative writing at the State University of New York Nassau Community College, and she's an executive board member of VITA, Women in the Literary Arts. She's also a busy and productive poet, author of I Want to Make You Safe, I'm the Man Who Loves You, Slaves to Do These Things, among others. Amy is being honored for her work with the 2015 Women's National Book Association Bookwoman Award, presented in New Orleans June 6th. Hi, Amy. Welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi, Susan. I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Now, first of all, congratulations on this award. It's got such a distinguished history.
I was completely floored when I got the email and then the phone call. I was like, are you sure you have the right Amy King? So, yeah.
And congratulations, too, on being part of the work that VITA does. I think every woman writer knows about VITA and what the VITA count is. But tell us how you got involved and what the work actually entails.
Well, I got involved because I used to blog a lot, of course, and if you've ever seen my social media presence, I'm a little bit contentious, but I'm very outspoken about feminist issues. And around the time that Kate Marvin and Erin Bellew were kind of talking about putting VITA together, and there's a whole origin story that you can find online about that, but they were talking about it, and I guess Kate was kind of scoping out who would be interested in participating in this kind of grassroots literary activist organization, and she just contacted me out of the blue. I happened to be blogging at the time about, I think it was Publishers Weekly's 100 Best Books or whatever, and of course, it was a terribly lopsided list, and I guess that's what caught Kate's attention. And so I've been involved since the beginning. I haven't always been on the executive board, but Kate and I and a couple of others pretty much did the first count from our homes. And after that, we had a count director come on the second year. But the first vision was to do what we call the count, which is basically, you know, we always suspected that there are gender disparities in publishing and, you know, best of lists and on syllabi and that sort of thing. So we initially just decided we're going to look at some of the career-making journals and magazines that, you know, you get published there. You're pretty much getting your name out there and on your way to getting more publications. And so we chose 12 of those and we just started counting, which was very labor-intensive but very revealing. And it's a simple concept. It took a while, but incredibly, we received such a strong feedback when we finally released it because, again, it was just something everybody suspects and feels, you know, kind of like that thing where women are always told you talk too much, but you kind of think about, well, I didn't actually talk as much as he did.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like we counted the number of authors and realized, okay, so here's some real tangible evidence that there really is gender disparity in publishing.
And reviewing.
Yeah, that's how we got started.
And you're expanding this count in other ways, aren't you?
Yeah, we've added on to the count. A couple years ago, we did what's called the larger literary landscape. Instead of just looking at the venues that, you know, have the money or the big names, you know, London Review of Books and that sort of thing, we thought, let's look at some smaller publications and see what their gender numbers look like. So we've done that for 2 years, and what we found with that, where there's less money, there's actually a little bit more parity, incredibly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so there's actually a history of this. Where the money is where the disparities really begin. So that was revealing, and now last year we attempted our first women of color count, which is where we started looking at race, and of course we found great disparities there, and the difference with that count is actually we reached out to all of the writers we were counting to ask them to complete a survey to self-identify. We didn't feel comfortable assigning race to anyone, so we didn't get I guess more than half of a turnout or a response, so we can't really quite call it a complete count yet. But even just looking at the responses that we got, they're pretty abysmal. Mm-hmm. So, and next year, we're adding on questions related to sexual orientation and disability issues so that we can kind of surface a lot more of these sociological factors that might come into play when, you know, editors are selecting work or soliciting, using their Rolodexes of, or their stable of writers, that sort of thing. A lot of different factors come into play with that.
So tell me, do you get any feedback from these assigning editors after they see the Vita count?
Yeah, we've gotten a lot of feedback from even the big dogs. For the first couple of years, across the board, from just average readers to editors and publishers, we got a lot of resistance in terms of trying to discount what we're doing, ranging from, you know, this isn't scientific, to this doesn't prove anything, to, you know, we're only publishing. You know, just a lot of different editors are saying things like, you know, we just published the best writing, and really appalling quotes. But I guess 2 years ago, we started getting a few positive saying, you know, our numbers look really bad and we're going to make an effort to change these numbers. And you can see some of those changes. I note them in each intro of the count each year. So if you look at 2013, you'll see a couple of things. You know, we're a really young organization still, and we've had incredible positive efforts to address these disparities. I guess people are taking us seriously.
Well, I know when I was a book review editor, at the end of the year, I'd go back and I'd look at all the book pages, and I'd break down the different categories of reviews, like male, female, local, national. But I'd also consider the North and South divide, things like that, fiction, nonfiction, because good reviewing is all about a mix. And I think what Vita does is show how that mix breaks down all too often. It's useful to have that information if you're really trying to do the job, I think.
Especially in the sense that a lot of these places don't pay attention. And we're just asking, you know, pay attention. You don't need to get defensive, but if you notice that your numbers are poor or your palette is very homogenous and male and white, you know, maybe you should think about reaching out to other writers. And that's what we call creating the conversation.
If you don't create the conversation, eventually your readers become bored and go away, I think.
Exactly.
Now, so much of your life is about activism. It's about the proper response to issues and events. So I wonder if you talk a little bit about your work with Poets for Living Waters, especially since that's something that springs directly from our part of the country.
That's another issue that I'm always paying attention to and anxious about. When the oil spill happened in the Gulf, Heidi and I, we just started talking about it and got very anxious about recognizing the need to have poets and writers be part of yet another conversation that shapes climate change. Because as we've seen, even the evolution of how we talk about these weather-related events, it's still happening. You know, we used to call it global warming. Now we're calling it climate change. And all the things around it relate to, you know, business. Do we fund these things that are supposed to combat it, supposed to change it? I mean, we made changes in the 70s to stop destroying the ozone layer. Why can't we recognize and call attention to from a human perspective, with empathy, as poets tend to engage? So one of the best ways and easiest and free ways to do it is online. So we put a call out to kind of gather voices to start responding to and humanizing this, because it historically was scientific, you know. And so we wanted to have poets be able to start shaping what lens we look at these events through. And that's why we started Poets for Living Waters as an initiative. And we got just tons. I mean, we could not in any capacity publish what we would receive. But the outpouring was massive. And then you can see other poets doing similar initiatives. Michael Rothenberg, I think his last name is, he has been doing 100,000 Poets for Change, where he has readings across the country, and he's really been active and consistent with it. Heidi and I have moved on a little bit to, we're working on this anthology now, some of the people that were part of Poets for Living Waters, but we're broadening it to account for a lot of different events. And we're not actually just doing poetry. We're having the writers also offer statements related to the various issues that stem from these events so that they can kind of have an impact on how, you know, we're talking about these issues. Because either you're creating the culture or you're just reflecting it.
Right. So. We've been talking with poet and activist Amy King, who is the winner of the 2015 Bookwoman Award, presented by the Women's National Book Association in New Orleans, June 6th. Amy, thank you so much for all you do.
Thank you so much, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Robert S. Brantley discusses and signs Henry Howard, Louisiana's Architect, Tuesday, June 9th from 6 to 8 at the Historic New Orleans Collection, 533 Royal Street, and again Thursday, June 11th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. James Blanchard and Joseph Bienvenu are the featured readers in the Blood Jet Poetry Series, Wednesday, June 10th at 8 at BJ's, 4301 Burgundy. The Octavia Book Science Fiction Book Club discusses Heat by Arthur Herzog, Saturday, June 13th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. The great poet Sonia Sanchez discusses her new book, SOS, Calling All Black People, a Black Arts Movement Reader, along with contributors to the anthology Mixed Company, Addie Sitchins, Jerry Hilt, Soraya Jean-Louis McElroy, Ambada Kazinantz, J.R. Ramakrishnan, and Christina K. Robinson. That's Saturday, June 13th at the Museum of Free People of Color, 2336 Esplanade Avenue. Bloomsday's coming up again. Don't miss this annual celebration of James Joyce's Ulysses, Tuesday, June 16th from 6 to 8 at the Irish House, 1432 St. Charles Avenue, with special guests Brian Boyles, Yuri Herrera, Wende Frequency Katwiwa, Maurice Carlos Ruffin, and Katie Simpson Smith. The children's program, Every Hero Has a Story, runs through July 30th. Just a few of the highlights include visits to libraries by the Audubon Zoomobile and Bugmobile, superhero crafts and story times, library visits by the New Orleans Fire Department, and much more. Children who read 8 books or 800 pages will receive a certificate and other awards. Unmask is the teen summer reading program, with events scheduled through August 1st. Teens will have the opportunity to take silk screening and tie-dyeing workshops, do-it-yourself crafting, electronics workshops, and much more. Teens who read 8 books or 800 pages will receive a certificate of prize and will be entered into a raffle for a bike. The adult summer reading program was such a big success last year that it's being offered again this year. Escape the Ordinary is the theme, and programs will run from June 6th through July 29th. A silent disco, performances by Jason Marsalis, CSI night, wine and coloring, and a superhero costume party are just a few of the many events scheduled. Jefferson Parish Library's summer reading program is also underway with many of the same themes. Check out jplibrary.net/SRP for a complete schedule. Greg Cartwright is heading up the Little Free Library's materials drive. The Central City Little Free Library Project is looking for reclaimed or scrap building materials to keep the project as green as possible. Here are some items that would be welcome: plywood at least 1/2 inch thick and preferably up to 1 inch, pieces of plywood that are at least 1/2 sheet or bigger, materials like corrugated tin, wood or slate shingles, hinges and knobs or handles for doors, and plexiglass, 8x10 pieces, old license plates or street signs or other things that could be siding or decoration, as well as high-quality oil-based primer. If you have pre-made boxes or cabinets about 2 feet by 2 feet or so that could be refashioned into a Little Free Library, they'll take those too. Check out the Central City Little Free Library Project on Facebook for more information or to arrange a pickup. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.